The North Korea policy review that the administration began in early February is still underway.
The U.S. Secretary of State heads to Asia later this week. We have a preview. It's Tuesday, March 14th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. There's so much more online as well. Join us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, China begins an ambitious plan. A look at trade between the U.S. and Vietnam. Plus, we speak to the director of Encore Awakens. We awaken right now to a brand new VOA Asia. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson heads to Asia this week, with stops beginning Wednesday in Tokyo, Seoul, and Beijing. It comes at a time of heightened tensions over North Korea's nuclear and missile programs, South Korea's political crisis, and security and trade tensions with China. A senior U.S. State Department official said last week Pyongyang needs to demonstrate a recognition that the only way out of its isolation and economic failure is to give up its nuclear and missile programs. He said U.S. policy is being reviewed and a range of things are being considered. Ankit Panda, associate editor of the Asia-Pacific current events publication The Diplomat, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the Trump administration may be moving away from any direct engagement with the North Koreans.
The North Korea policy review that the administration began in early February is still underway. My inclination will be to wait and see how this really pans out. I think Tillerson's trip could provide the administration with important data points about what precisely the Chinese, the South Koreans, and the Japanese are expecting from the United States.
Can you give us a sense as to where the policy may go?
Certainly, we've seen headlines that military options are on the table and being considered, which is normal. Every incoming administration considers the full gamut of policy options available on any given problem, certainly North Korea. What I'll be looking to see is how Tillerson's time in China goes. Last week, the Chinese foreign minister laid out a quid pro quo that it thought that the United States and North Korea should consider, namely that the United States and South Korea would cease their large-scale conventional exercises that are ongoing right now. In exchange, North Korea would freeze its missile and nuclear development programs, which is an interesting proposal since that actually comports quite well with what the North Koreans have said in the past. So we might see similar talks play out between Tillerson and his Chinese counterpart in Beijing.
His trip is somewhat complicated by the fact that South Korea's President Park Geun-hye has left office and the country is obligated to hold elections in the next 60 days. What is the concern that he faces with regard to South Korea and its political system?
I think Tillerson's top task in South Korea will be reassurance. And in that way, his trip will be quite similar to Defense Secretary Jim Mattis' trip to the region in early February as well. As you note, this election will be critical. I think most experts and analysts are expecting the government to lurch to the left, with the progressive candidate from the Minju Party, Moon Jae-in, looking quite strong in recent polls. And if he comes to power, South Korea may decide to take a different tack altogether towards North Korea, returning to something like a 2.0 variant of the Sunshine Policy, for instance, restoring the Kaesong Industrial Complex that was terminated after last year's first nuclear test. So I think Tillerson and the Trump administration more broadly need to be cognizant of this election that's coming up in South Korea, simply because the way this alliance works is with consultation. Right now, everything that the United States has been doing with regard to North Korea has been with the assumption that it will have the support of a more conservative government in Seoul, and that might no longer be true come early May.
Ankit Panda says in China, analysts will watch closely for any sign of an early summit between President Donald Trump and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping. He said in such a meeting, it could come as soon as early next month. The two leaders spoke by phone on February 9th. He says Tillerson's trip could go a long way toward setting an agenda for that summit. We invite you to read more on our top story by following us on VOA Asia on Facebook. And also the VOANews.com website. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOANews.com. Experts say North Korea must be held accountable for crimes against humanity. U.S. Vice President Pence to tour Asia next month amid security crisis. Proposal for more open internet hits Great Firewall of China. Refugees surge into China as Myanmar ethnic border conflict escalates. Sources indicate Japan plans to send largest warship to South China Sea. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia, and be sure to also check out our voanews.com website. As we continue now with VOA Asia, U.S. President Donald Trump tweeted this week that his administration is only just beginning, following significantly better-than-expected numbers in the jobs report by ADP Research Institute. But Washington is not the only country looking to make changes. VOA Asia's Steve Miller spoke with reporter Saibal Dasgupta about Beijing's new Made in China 2025 initiative and what it hopes to achieve.
China became the factory to the world, producing low-end goods and selling to the whole world, and became the largest trader in the whole world. But today, China's exports are falling because the world does not need any more of those low-quality goods. And the world needs sophisticated goods. China suddenly realizes that the entire production system that it has, it is low-end and it is not well-equipped. So it wants to modernize and upgrade the technology, but it does not have the R&D to do it. So it has come up with this plan in which it will spend a few $100 billion, Made in China 2025 plan. By 2025, it wants to upgrade 10 different kinds of technology, which is information technology, semiconductors, robotics, new energy vehicles, medical devices, and biopharmaceuticals.
So how are they going to upgrade and modernize these different fields?
So China has three plans. One is to acquire whole entire companies in Europe and US and in Canada and acquire the technology. And it already started doing it. Second, the president of European Chamber of Commerce is complaining that China is putting pressure on them that you give up your technology if you want market access in our country. So this is the second method. And the third method, it is going to hire talent from across the world. Talent who will work in Chinese universities and talent which will work in Chinese companies. So these are the three ways it wants to acquire new technology. Instead of doing what the whole world does, which is to set up an R&D center, it is not doing that. It is acquiring it.
China tends to use state-run entities for its businesses. Doesn't that present some kind of problem in achieving this goal?
That really is the biggest challenge, because Chinese private sector have done wonderfully well, companies like Tencent and Alibaba. But the Chinese Communist Party does not trust them. Chinese Communist Party wants to go with people they understand, they trust, and part of the party cadre. State-owned companies are in the major businesses of steel, iron, coal, petrochemicals, oil, all those major businesses. But they are very sluggish. They are very slow to adopt new technology. And there's a whole lot of corruption in them. This is what the European Chamber is saying, that they are choosing the wrong winners. These are not the people who can really implement it.
Saibal Dasgupta is our reporter in Beijing, bringing this story to us. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks a lot.
Happening now in Asia, the United States has started deploying attack drones in South Korea after Seoul began rolling out the U.S. THAAD missile defense system. A U.S. military spokesman said the drones were to counter provocative actions by North Korea, enhancing intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance capabilities. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're always glad to have you along with us on VOA Asia. Vietnam will test U.S. President Donald Trump's openness to one-on-one trade deals as it starts nudging Washington for an eventual agreement to replace its role in the defunct Trans-Pacific Partnership. Official media outlets in Vietnam say Prime Minister Nguyen Xuan Phuc told an American business delegation last week he was ready to visit the United States, hoping to meet Trump for a discussion about trade. Vietnam depends heavily on factory exports, which amounts to about 19% of its economy. A deal with the United States could mean a lot, says Marie Durand, senior vice president at Moody's Investors Service in Singapore.
A trade agreement with the U.S. for a large market would certainly bring some benefits there. That's clear. It would be about kind of anchoring these export markets with a trade agreement in place.
Analysts say Trump is not expected to prioritize free trade deals in the short term, but he may someday consider them. Nguyen may have a chance at working out a trade deal with the United States because American firms selling products such as fast food, mobile phones, and even insurance want more access to Vietnam's fast-growing middle class. Rahul Bajoria, a regional economist with Barclays in Singapore, says manufacturing companies might want to access Vietnam's markets as well.
You would expect the direction of goods to be from Vietnam to U.S. picking up more sharply than the other way around. It could be the case that there might be some pressure from the large industrial manufacturers, like the aircraft manufacturers or the train companies. All of them may be much more interested in exporting to Vietnam.
The United States is Vietnam's top export market, exporting $38.1 billion. Importing $8.7 billion. But in January, imports increased 14.6%, pointing to a possible soft spot in Vietnam for Western brands. American names such as Apple, Dell, and Starbucks are easy to find in places such as the financial center, Ho Chi Minh City. Something not lost on Vojislav Milenkovic, an analyst with the business advisory BDG Insights.
The U.S. companies could export to Vietnam, to a market that is growing so fast, with 90-plus million people who are very brand conscious, where Western foreign brands have very high reputation. So you can see this every day on the street. You can see that people are trying to save and to buy high-quality products from the foreign countries.
Leaders in Hanoi had hoped the TPP would give them access to the U.S. markets plus 10 other countries, including Japan. Trump withdrew the United States from the TPP in January, saying it would hurt his country. Because of the size of the U.S. economy, Trump's withdrawal made it effectively impossible for other countries to keep the TPP alive. So Vietnamese leaders began looking instead to other trade deals. An agreement reached with the European Union in 2015 is due to take effect next year if it clears hurdles in the European bloc's parliament. China is also keen to bolster trade ties, but Vietnam hopes to avoid dependence on the longtime political rival that's known for unloading cheap, mass-produced goods in Vietnam at prices lower than what local companies can charge. You're listening to VOA Asia.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This news alert from VOA Asia, the Chinese government reported 61 fatalities and 160 cases of human infection from the H7N9 strain of bird flu in February. The number is higher than in previous years, and it brings the death toll in this winter's outbreaks to 161. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. You're listening to VOA Asia. A link has been found between type 2 diabetes and cancer throughout Asia. As the incidence of diabetes rises around the world, experts say more cancer screening may be called for among Asians with diabetes. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
Researchers at New York University's School of Medicine found that diabetes increased the risk of cancer death among Asians by an average of 26%, a statistic similar in the West. Data for the new study drew on an analysis of 770,000 people with type 2 diabetes throughout East and South Asia. The countries included India, Bangladesh, China, Taiwan, Singapore, South Korea, and Japan. The average age of participants at the start of the study was 54. Participants with the disease were followed for an average of 13 years to see if they developed cancer and what types. During that time, more than 37,300 cancer deaths were identified. Study lead author Yu Chen is an epidemiologist professor at NYU School of Medicine's Department of Population Health. Chen says Asians with type 2 diabetes are more likely to be diagnosed with rarer cancers than Westerners, including cancers of the liver, thyroid, and kidney, which was double the risk compared to non-diabetics in Asia. People who had diabetes were also more than 2.5 times more likely to die from cancer of the endometrium and 1.7 times more likely to die from breast cancer compared to Asians who were not diabetic. The number of cancers of the gallbladder and bile ducts in Asia were comparable to those in the West, according to Chen. Those sites are closer in the body to the pancreas where insulin is made. Chen thinks there may be several mechanisms at work. Chief among them is scientific data suggesting that insulin may in some way stimulate the growth of cancer, according to Chen.
Patients with diabetes, they have high level of insulin, and some cancer cells, they're very sensitive to insulin. So it may, promote the tumor growing.
The findings were published in the journal Diabetologia. Chen says the study was undertaken because research focusing on an association between diabetes and cancer throughout Asia has been small. She says the findings suggest type 2 diabetes should be added to the list of cancer risk factors, along with diet and cigarette smoking.
Cancer prevention needs to take into account for diabetes. Lifestyles related to diabetes may reduce risk of diabetes and also cancer.
Chen says perhaps diabetics should receive more cancer screenings in addition to medical interventions to reduce the risk of diabetes overall. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Developing at this hour in Asia, Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte told his military to assert ownership of a portion of the South China Sea by building structures to assert sovereignty. President Duterte acknowledged he can't match China's military might, so he ordered the Philippine military to relay his message to China in a friendly way. VOA Asia keeps you informed all day on Facebook at VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, with a focus on modern Cambodia, where its population strives to move beyond the dark period of the Khmer Rouge, Ankara Awakens, A Portrait of Cambodia, is an emotional film chronicling Cambodian history from ancient times all the way up to the present. VOA Khmer reporter Sophie Dafai spoke with director and producer Robert Lieberman about the film. He's a novelist, filmmaker, and member of the physics faculty at Cornell University. They started the conversation by asking what he meant by the phrase Ankara Awakens.
It is essentially talking about how I think that Cambodia has come out of a very dark period, and it's awakened from, of course, the Pol Pot regime. So it's the awakening, and I find it among the young people, the older generation, you know, those who lived through the Khmer Rouge period, are rather damaged and fearful, whereas the young are awakening, and I think they're becoming, among other things, politically active, and I think they're much more optimistic than their parents. So that's, I think, the awakening.
What are the main takeaway the audience can learn from your film?
That's a tough question. I think, you know, documentaries often have a character that you follow or a group of people you follow. The character in this film is the country of Cambodia. And we're going to take you on a journey. We're going to take you from ancient Angkor through the French colonial period, a protectorate period, you know, through, you know, the Vietnam War, Pol Pot, and then ultimately the Vietnamese, you know, entering Cambodia, overthrowing, you know, the Khmer Rouge. We're going to take you through right up to the present day and into the future. Why do you want to watch it? Well, it's not just educational. I think it's entertaining, but also it's a rather emotional film. I showed it to some of my students at Cornell, and they were crying.
You talk a little bit about the problems that Cambodia face right now, like the education is not good, the healthcare is not good. So can you give the main problem that Cambodia is facing right now?
I can give it to you in one word. Mm-hmm. I think education. If you have an educated populace, things get better. The educational level is terrible. I mean, those who have money can go to good schools, but the rest of the country doesn't have that. One thing I've noticed that maybe other people haven't noticed is that nobody reads here. They don't read books. And this is kind of shocking to me as a teacher. You know, I don't see people carrying books. I don't see people reading books. Cambodians are not readers. And that is very disturbing. And that's part of education. You need to create the population that reads. It's through reading that you get really information, by reading from many different sources. So if you educate the children, that's the future of the country. By the way, the biggest resource of a country is not its mineral wealth. It is not its timber wealth or its agricultural wealth. The wealth of a country, the greatest resource, is the young people. And you have to take care of them. You have to, you know, ensure their health and their education.
Thank you very much for joining VOA Khmer interview.
It was my pleasure.
Robert H. Lieberman is producer and director of the film Angkor Awakens, A Portrait of Cambodia. Our thanks to VOA's Khmer Service for that interview. You've been listening to VOA Asia. Be sure to check us out on Facebook at that same name, VOA Asia. Like us while you're there. You can also download our podcast and take VOA Asia wherever you go, anytime, all day long. Follow us as well on voanews.com, where we stream our program every day. Our director is Tracy Carter. Engineer, John Ellison. Funk in the First Degree, check it out. Managing editor, Diane Gao. Our program written today by Steve Miller. Ali Ogden heading our social media efforts. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you have a great day ahead. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On March 6th, North Korea fired four ballistic missiles that flew about 1,000 kilometers, with three of them landing in Japan's exclusive economic zone, according to South Korean and Japanese officials. This is the latest in a series of missile test launches of various ranges in recent months. In response to this ongoing threat from North Korea, the United States and South Korea committed in July 2016 to the deployment of Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, THAAD, to South Korea. The United States Pacific Command, or PACCOM, recently deployed the first elements of THAAD. North Korea's accelerating campaign of nuclear and ballistic missile tests threaten international peace and security and violate multiple United Nations Security Council resolutions, PACCOM officials said, adding that the THAAD deployment contributes to a layered missile defense system, thereby enhancing the alliance's defense against North Korean missile threats. Continued provocative actions by North Korea, to include the March 6th launch of multiple missiles, only confirm the prudence of our alliance decision last year to deploy THAAD to South Korea, said Navy Admiral and PACCOM Commander Harry Harris. We will resolutely honor our alliance commitments to South Korea and stand ready to defend ourselves, the American homeland, and our allies. THAAD is a strictly defensive system and poses no threat to other countries in the region, PACCOM officials said. It is designed to intercept and destroy short- and medium-range ballistic missiles inside or outside the atmosphere during their final phase of flight. PACCOM joint military forces remain vigilant in the face of North Korean ballistic missile threats and provocations and are fully committed to working closely with South Korea to maintain security in the region.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.